Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening and welcome to Interchange. My name is William Morris. Tonight we have a special interview. Interchange reporter Susan Hu goes in depth with Marianne Foudé. Recently, Susan had the opportunity to sit down with Marianne to discuss the tenets of Islam, including the beliefs and the responsibilities of Muslims and their view of the world outside Islam. Here's Susan and Marianne.
Welcome to Interchange. My name is Susan Hu. Today we're here with Dr. Marianne Foudé, a formerly part-time professor at IUPUI. We'll talk about Islam. Welcome to Interchange, Dr. Foudé.
Thank you.
We are now at the end of August. The Ramadan of this year just finished. Mm-hmm. We know that every day during this month, Muslims around the world spend the daylight hours in a complete fast. Can you explain us a little bit more about Ramadan and what does this mean to the Muslims?
Well, Ramadan is based on a lunar calendar in Islam. So this year it began on the 1st of August and ended on the 30th, and next year it will start about 10 days earlier. It's a time of spiritual purification. It's a time of fasting, of like a spiritual retreat in other religions where people take time to withdraw from the world, so to speak, a lot of worldly activities and focus on God and reading the Quran, meditation, fasting in the sense of, unlike Lent in the Christian world, fasting starts from dawn, not sunup, dawn. So you must eat before dawn, must finish your food and drink before that, and then you cannot have anything until sunset. And in the summer months, it's pretty, really long. It's, you know, it's because of our time changes now, like 9:15.
And
the longest time.
People were not supposed to drink water during the daytime.
No water, either. No food, no drinking, no smoking. Nothing enters the mouth. But if you cannot fast, then you should not. If you have, for example, a chronic condition where you need to be on medicine all the time, you're not supposed to fast. It's not supposed to be a hardship. It's supposed to be a privilege, actually. And fasting, as I said, is a spiritual purification, but it's also a time... you know, on a worldly level, a physical level, I should say, it's also a time to just have, you know, be in sympathy with the poor, to have an understanding of what it's like not to be able to eat and drink, and bring a little, I would say, help incline you toward being charitable. That's one of the most important pillars of Islam is charity, to give alms, to give to the needy. And so this, I think, also helps people realize that when you're hungry and thirsty and you can't have anything, and you realize there are people who are struggling with this all the time, it makes you more sympathetic. But it's basically a time of spiritual purification, turning inward and focusing on God and reading the Quran, chanting the Quran, hearing people chant the Quran. Some Muslims will actually take the last 10 days, which are considered the most propitious, because the Quran was revealed during the month of Ramadan. That's why it's number one, why it's we fast. Secondly, it's the traditional date of when the Quran was revealed to Muhammad via the Archangel Gabriel is the 27th of Ramadan. Tradition says it's one of the odd-numbered months, like 21, 23, 25, 27, or like that. But tradition, it's traditionally accepted as the 27th.
27th.
That's called Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, when the Quran was revealed and to the Prophet Muhammad, alayhi salat wa salam, peace be upon him, as we say. And that last week, a lot of Muslims will just take the time off from work and spend it in retreat, spiritual retreat, meditation. And some people actually spend the entire week in a mosque. I've known people who would, you know, just go home to sleep and come back to the mosque in the morning, spend the entire day praying until, of course, until the time to break your fast. And then they either eat in the mosque, because a lot of times the community brings food and everyone comes and eats together and then they pray. Or they'll go home. But usually it's considered a blessing to eat with other people, not eat alone.
Can we say that's an idea of sharing with others?
Yes, definitely. You're always supposed to share your meal with others. Eat, you know, either eat with family, with neighbors, with friends. You know, ideally you should not eat alone. But of course, in this day and age, it's a little not always possible. But at least during Ramadan, you're always supposed to try and eat with others. So that's why the mosques always have community meals, and different families will get together and pitch in and provide the food.
So for all the Muslims, Ramadan is a month when we can purify our spirit and have some reflections of life.
Exactly. Reflect on your life. Lead a more examined life.
Okay, let's go back a little bit to Islam. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's the principal beliefs in Islam, and also what are the basic practice in Islam?
The basic beliefs are very similar to the other Abrahamic traditions, Judaism and Christianity. Islam believes in one creator God, who's both creator, both the creator and the personal God, named Allah in Arabic, but that's just the Arabic word for God. It's not...
There's no translation into English
just
or
God.
Any other.
Allah is God. A lot of Muslims prefer to use the word Allah because it seems to have all-encompassing meaning. But in English, that all-encompassing meaning is God. So I use God. And there's God who is transcendent and immanent. So he's both in the world and outside the world. He is, the Quran says, he's closer to you than your jugular vein. So he's within us, the divine spark that created all of us. Or that was put in all of us, I should say, that that is the God within, the divine within. And when we leave this world, that divine spark, if you will, returns to God. In fact, there's a beautiful verse in the Quran that is said when someone dies, or if there's really great difficulty that one is going through, you say, "We belong to God, and to Him we return." So there's the belief in God, His angels, His scriptures. His, I always say it in Arabic, I'm trying to think about the scriptures, the angels, his prophets and messengers, and the predestination of good and evil, as you might call it, and judgment day. And let me go into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The idea that, well, of course, God, the all-knowing God, the all-powerful, both the personal and the transcendent God, the God you pray to and the God that oversees the entire universe, this is all Allah. All the prophets and messengers that he's sent throughout time to warn different communities. Islam is a very universal religion in that sense that it says that we have sent many prophets and messengers over time to warn different people so that at the day of judgment, you can't say we didn't know. So all groups have their religious leaders. And Islam says it didn't bring anything new. It just brought the primordial teachings. It just reminded us. Through those messengers. And in fact, there is no original sin. You're not born with sin. You're born with this tendency to forget God. And when you forget God, you do things that are maybe not very nice, and you have to be reminded. So Islam is, you know, says that that mankind through time needs to be reminded. So the so-called sin would be forgetfulness. We call it ghafla in Arabic. It's forgetting God. Mm-hmm. And so Islam, as all the other major religions, and, well, I suppose even the minor ones that we don't know about, all the religions come to teach man how to relate to himself, to God, to his fellow human beings, to the world. I mean, being stewards of the planet, I think all the religions teach you to respect nature because it's all part of the divine. God created the world and everyone and everything in it, so therefore we should respect everything, including inanimate objects. We think are inanimate, but the Sufis say they really do have an awareness, and we're just not aware of their awareness.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, so you respect everything, and you, like the Native Americans, you take what you need, and you bless whatever you're using. Even the Prophet Muhammad used to say a blessing when he put on his clothes, mm-hmm. and when he removed them. When you go to the restroom, I mean, there's something to say, to be said for each act of life or ritual in life, because religion is, well, our lives here are a ritual. You know, the practicing your faith, it helps to help you see that all of life is sacred. So there are rituals for every aspect of life, at least in
to show some our of the, respect
yeah,
to everything.
Many, I mean, Hinduism has a huge amount of rituals. Buddhism also, I think Judaism has its rituals. Christianity has its rituals depending on which denomination. Some of them have kind of made them sort of streamline things in their faith. But I think Islam also has these rituals, and also the understanding that we all return to God, we should all respect one another and that sort of thing. So that's the ultimate teaching, is that we didn't bring anything new. We just, you know, God said, we are here to remind you. You know, the prophet came, as all the other prophets, Jesus, Moses, Abraham. Adam is considered the first prophet. So they're all revered in Islam. There's no one who's rejected.
You talked about the judgment day earlier. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit more about this?
Well, like all the other Abrahamic traditions, you have a day of judgment when God, when all of humanity gathers to be judged, you know, according to the Quran, that's what we believe. The ritual of the pilgrimage, there's a part of the ritual where everyone is dressed in white garments, and they're all standing for a few hours. And it's supposed to symbolize the standing at the Day of Judgment. And I was quite moved when I saw that, because you can't tell who's high-born, low-born, educated, and uneducated, you know, a prince, a pauper. You can't tell a thing, because everyone is dressed alike and everyone is praying and asking for forgiveness. And we really are one. I came away with really, like, it doesn't matter what country you come from, what language you speak, what color your skin is, and we really are one. And when I was in Mecca, I saw how black, white, yellow, didn't matter. Everyone was there praying and following the same rituals and being kind to one another. It was really touching.
Yeah, that must be.
The other beliefs you were asking me about, the practices you were asking mm-hmm. about, the five pillars,
yeah.
as we call
what
them.
What are the five pillars?
The first one is not really a practice. It's a belief. It's the belief in one God and the belief that Muhammad was his prophet. It's called the Shahada. The next belief are the five daily prayers. Now, that is a practice. Five daily prayers. They're said at a particular time of the day, each one. And if you miss them by chance, then you make them up later. But the morning prayer should be said between dawn and sunrise. A noon prayer, because of our time zone change, it's usually, I guess, around 1:30, 2 o'clock, mm-hmm. somewhere in there up until mid-afternoon. And then you have the afternoon prayer, which is said up until sunset or right before sunset. Then the sunset prayer, and then the night prayer, which is after nightfall. So, or the evening prayer, they call it. So those are the five basic ones. And then there are extra prayers that one can say. They call them sunnah prayers, which are extra prayers that the Prophet used to say before and after each of the five daily prayers. And then during Ramadan, there's a special series of prayers that are called Taraweeh, and they are said only during Ramadan after the evening prayer. And so after everyone's had their meal and prayed.
But that is only during Ramadan.
Only during Ramadan. And the goal during the Taraweeh prayers are to read the whole Quran by the end of the month. So when you're praying, the first two units of prayer or cycles of prayer, in the evening you say three at sunset and four in the evening at night prayer. During the first two units of prayer, some verses of the Quran are recited. And normally when you're just doing it by yourself, you might recite some short surahs, short chapters, minimum like 4 or 5 verses, you would say. And then you say the rest of the prayer, which is kind of a canonical, we might say. There's a certain ritual to that prayer. During Ramadan, you actually, during the Taraweeh prayers, you actually, the person leading the prayer, the imam, he will be reciting many, many verses so that by the end of the 30 days, the entire Quran has been recited during the evening prayers.
During this one month.
Yes. So, and the Quran is divided into sections. So if someone wants to read the whole thing in a week, there are seven, it's divided into 7 sections and you can continue. If you want to read it over 30 days, like for the Ramadan, there are sections in the margins that'll show you where you stop each, where is the 30th part of the book, and you recite that 30th and then you continue on. So, and then there are young people who study the Quran and learn to memorize it. It's about the size of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And it's considered a great blessing to memorize it and to learn to chant it as well. And there's great barakah, as we call it, or blessing in doing it. It's also a great blessing in hearing it, even if you can't understand all the words. It's a great blessing to hear.
So all Muslims are reading Quran during Ramadan?
Well, they try, and those whose first language is in Arabic will read it in translation and perhaps hear, or might have a tape, a CD of someone chanting it and just listening
just
to it that way.
Just recite it.
Yeah, but ideally, Muslims are encouraged to learn Arabic, at least enough to say some
prayers,
say the verses, recite the verses in Arabic for the prayers. You actually need that. Some people just learn a few so they can just say their prayers. Others want to really learn more and study. And it's like any spiritual tradition, the more you learn, the greater the knowledge, greater the blessing, greater the understanding, I think greater the peace when you understand what's happening, and from a spiritual perspective, it makes a big difference.
So that's the second pillar of the 5 pillars?
Yes, the 5 daily prayers. The next one is zakat, or almsgiving, giving money in charity. Zakat is for needy Muslims. There's another kind of charity called sadaqah, and that's for anyone who's needy, regardless of religion, you know, mm-hmm. from an atheist all the way down to, you know, anyone, not following any tradition, just someone in need. So anybody homeless on the street, you'd give to, or to charities, different institutions. So in Islam, unlike the Christian faith where you tithe 10% of your gross income, in Islam you tithe 2.5% of your net income after expenses. So, Islam feels like you need to take care of yourself and your family and relatives, and then what's left after after taxes and expenses, then you'd give 2.5% of that to the mosque or to, yeah, or needy Muslims. If you know someone directly you want to give to, that's fine. If you prefer to give to a charity or a local mosque, which will give it to the needy locally, that's fine too. So that's the third one. The next one would be the fast of Ramadan. So it's Sawm, we call it, the fast. And as I said, that's 30 days fasting from food and drink and cigarettes. Some people say injections are okay, but not anything mm-hmm. orally taken in. So, but I think if you really need to have some kind of medicine on a daily basis, then it's preferable if you don't fast, because it's not supposed to be a hardship. It's supposed to
be more like an option.
A blessing. I mean, it's really not something you take lightly. I mean, you really should fast if you can. So it's not right that you say, oh, I don't feel well, so I'm not going to fast. I mean, now, women who are pregnant, or women having their period, or women who have just given birth are not supposed to fast. You make that up later. So if you've missed a week of fasting because you had your period, then you just
make
it up later. And you actually make the intention the night before. You intend to fast, and then you fast the next day. So people get up in the very early to have a breakfast, and then something that'll carry them through the day, And the wintertime is much shorter, so usually people will fast in the wintertime to make up for whatever they've missed. The last one is the pilgrimage, called the Hajj. And the pilgrimage is an obligation on Muslims to perform once in your life. Now, there are people who do it many times, but the obligation is to go once if you are physically and financially able. So it's an ordeal in a sense, because you have hundreds of thousands of Muslims all descending at the same time. So it's quite a physical challenge. And also financially, you should be able to afford it. In bygone eras, a person would not go on the pilgrimage unless he had enough money saved up for a year to support his family in the event something happened to him. And of course, back then, it was a long trek to get there. You know, some people traveled overland by caravan, others by ship, and then overland. So, and people, unfortunately, some people were accosted during the trip, so they may not return. So the idea was to make sure that your family's provided for a year.
And you're able to afford it.
Yes, so it shouldn't be a hardship financially. If you can't afford it, then the intention to go is acceptable. I think God would accept the fact that you wanted to go, but you couldn't, you know. But ideally, you should go once in your life. And you go to Mecca, to the site of the Kaaba. That's the direction that everyone prays. And so the Qibla, as we call it in Arabic, is the direction of prayer. And so when you get to Mecca, everyone who's, you know, you're surrounding the Kaaba, so you just pray toward the Kaaba, and it's a beautiful place. I mean, I was really moved to see it. It was amazing. It was like something alive, really pulsating. It was like almost radiating energy. I was really amazed.
How many times have you been there?
Once I was there.
How was it?
It was quite moving. I didn't expect to feel that way. I just went as an obligation, but when I got there, when I saw the Kaaba, I was moved to tears, and I really couldn't understand why. And I realized, I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, of course, all these prophets, you know, Abraham is, he and Ishmael or Ismail were the first to repair the Kaaba. So from them, And Isaac and his descendants, and Ishmael and his descendants, they actually prayed together at the Kaaba until it became, over the generations, it became a place where idols were kept, were housed as well. And that's when Isaac and Isaac's descendants fell away from it. I mean, moved away. Like they no longer prayed there because it was a place for idols and polytheists. So they left. And but, you know, Muhammad came to restore that purity and the oneness. And in his day, he was born around 570 of the Christian era. So when he became a prophet, the message came to him. He was around 40, so that would have put it about 610 A.D. or C.E. And there were like 360 idols in the Kaaba, one for each day of the year, because Mecca had been a center where they had a lot of trading. It was a trading center. So you hear about the medieval fairs of Europe. It was the same idea here. People from all over came, brought their wares, their goods, their animals, whatever they wanted to trade. And poets came, and they would spar with each other, seeing who could create, you know, and
it's
create,
like an economical and cultural center.
Yeah, exactly. Who could compose the best poems, and all of that was rich oral tradition. And so everyone would bring a one of their gods, you know, their god, the god of their tribe or something. They would bring it and leave it in the Kaaba. And the Meccans didn't want to offend anyone, so they accepted all of them. And they also had the family of the prophet also had control of the water. So that was, and they were. One of the traditions in the Middle East is hospitality, especially among the Arab tribes. And you offer water or whatever a person needs because they've traveled so far to get there. So they were known for hospitality and so forth. So when the Prophet Muhammad became victorious a few years later, he was persecuted and everything. But finally, when he was victorious, he removed all the idols out of the Kaaba except a picture of the Virgin Mary and Jesus. He left those. He removed everything else. So the Kaaba is a very important center. And I think what moved me was I felt like it was alive when I saw it. I felt like there was something just pulsating, like radiating. And I thought, well, of course, all these prophets and messengers and Sufi masters and all these wonderfully pious people have been there praying in this direction. All this energy, this, you know, barakah, as we call it, this grace, is just emanating from it. And I was just really amazed at it was palpable, you know, almost palpable, the feeling. I was quite moved to see that and to feel it.
Probably only when you are actually there, you can feel it.
Yeah, it's a totally different feeling to be there. I mean, to see pictures is one thing, but the atmosphere is totally different. It sounds bizarre, but it's almost like I heard the swishing of angels or something. I mean,
wow.
It was really, I was just amazed because I wasn't expecting it. I wasn't born a Muslim, so I didn't grow up with the tradition, but when I got there, I was just so moved that I always hoped to go back. So one day, and people can go back for what they call Umrah, which is going to visit the house of God there, the Kaaba, to go there at non-pilgrimage times. That's called the Umrah, so like the lesser pilgrimage. The main real pilgrimage is the pilgrimage during the pilgrimage season, which is 70 days after Ramadan.
70 days after Ramadan.
So that'll be coming up later in the fall, yes. And people will make all sorts of plans to go, and the rituals are for almost a week, not quite, but people like to stay and go to Medina to visit the tomb of the Prophet and to go to Mecca. So they make a trip to both towns, usually, both cities, while they're there. And some people consider jihad another pillar, the sixth pillar, although there's really five, but the sixth one, I wanted to bring it up because I get questions about that all the time. In Islam, you have what you call the greater jihad, the greater struggle, and the lesser struggle. The greater struggle, jihad al-akbar, that one is actually the struggle within yourself to do the right thing.
The struggle within yourself to do the right thing.
To do the right thing, like controlling your tongue when you want to say something to somebody that wouldn't be nice, but you stop yourself. Doing the right thing even when no one's watching, because it's the right thing to do. You know, helping somebody, not gossiping when everyone else is talking about somebody, and you, instead of chiming in, you watch yourself. Trying to do the right thing and to practice the golden rule, to treat others as you would want to be treated. So if someone's unkind to you or cuts you off in traffic, you know, just center yourself and not react.
More like self-control.
Yeah, yes, but in a good way. I mean, it's like not so you can blow up later, so that you really realize that, you know, whatever happens is God's will. So sometimes people do things as a test. You know, you don't like it, but it really, if you look at it, it's a kind of a test. How am I going to react to this? Am I going to just let my emotions control me in this situation, or am I going to step back and think and then respond? Or not even respond, just let it go. Just let it go. Don't take everything personally.
Wow.
So it's difficult. It's difficult to practice that. That's why it's called the greater struggle. The lesser struggle is warfare. But unlike what people are led to think, real warfare in Islam is a defensive war.
Defensive war.
Defensive war. You can never attack another group of people because you want something they have. That's not right. What you do is defend yourself if you're attacked, and your home and your family. And if they want peace, if they decide we need to surrender or we want to make peace, and you know, this is not a good idea, then you're supposed to accept that and make peace with them. You're not supposed to have an ongoing war on and on. But you have the right to defend yourself. So it's never a war of aggression. It's supposed to be a war in the case of self-defense, you know, that you've been attacked. So that's the real difference. And that is the lesser one, because the Prophet, you know, said it's much easier to fight others than to control yourself. So that's the reason.
Yeah, talking about wars, there are so many wars. They look like they were caused by religions. Mm-hmm. But how do you think about that? Is it more a political, economic reason, or?
I think so, but I'm not a political scientist, but just to observe over the years what we've done, our actions overseas, we wouldn't tolerate a, a fraction of what we do to other countries, I'm afraid. So I think it's unfortunate that we have to demonize people and then justify why we're going in there. And everyone knows that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, but yet we attacked them viciously. And they're still in a terrible state. I don't think that's a very compassionate way to behave in the world. It's not practicing the golden rule. And we weren't attacked. They didn't threaten us. You know, this is the irony. We think they're all against us and threatening us, but they aren't. They just want to be left alone, live in peace, and not. But you know, as I say, there are always different reasons why we go to war. And I think the Muslims, you know, they just felt like they're under siege. I mean, you know, thank God there's an Arab Spring, but unfortunately we control what happens. We like to control whoever comes to power. And I think that's why a lot of Muslims and Christians, you know, they're Arab Christians as well. There are Muslims who are not Arabs. Excuse me. So depending on the person's educational level or their economic level, they have a different view of things. Some people just feel like, first, we're to blame. We have these terrible leaders. And others think, well, no, every time we try to get a leader, someone thwarts it from outside. So, I mean, you have different opinions, really. But ultimately, I know they'd just like to live in peace and have what we have in the sense of having a vibrant economy that, I think it's still vibrant in spite of what people think, that we have, you know, that we have self-determination, and they would like that too. So, but, you know, you'll get many opinions just like you will here. But I don't think religion, the religious part, I think that's only been a misunderstanding in this country. Also, a lot of it has been economic and political. For example, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and he discriminated against the Shiite majority population. So, of course, when they came to power, they kind of wreaked havoc on those who had treated them badly. I don't think that's really a question of religion, but more of politics and economics. And if everyone had had the same opportunities for advancement in the society, for education, for jobs, and all that, I don't think you would have seen any kind of problem between the two sects, Sunni and Shi'i. In fact, I have friends, and I know many people where one person's spouse is Sunni, the other is Shiite. I mean, there really is not that big a difference.
So
for most
Sunni
people.
And Shi'i, there are two sects in Muslims.
Yes, the Sunnis traditionally have believed they're the majority. They believed in a succession after the Prophet died. They believed in succession by election, like the best man be chosen to rule. The Shiite, it comes from the word Shi'at Ali, the partisans of Ali, Shi'at as the word, it became Shiite. They wanted a dynastic succession. So they wanted the Prophet's grandson, Hassan, to succeed, well, first Ali, because he was his cousin, and his wife was the daughter of the Prophet. So they wanted Ali to succeed the Prophet Muhammad at his death. When Ali died, they wanted his son Hassan to succeed. He deferred to some other opponent, so his brother Hussein tried to take back the power at the bequest of all these followers. And he lost as well. He was killed. And because of that, you have a split developed. And the Shiites are the people who felt like the Prophet's grandsons and their descendants should have been ruling. And the Shiite and the Sunnis say, no, it should be by the Sunnah, the custom of the day, which is that that the tribal elders choose the best man for the position. And that's how it divided up. And then there are certain prayers and things that are a little different with each Sunni and Shi'i branch, but, you know, with one branch or the other. But I don't think there's nothing really major. They're all believing in the five pillars. They're all practicing. They have extra prayers maybe for the Prophet's family, things like that. But in general, there's not a really big difference. But it depends on where you come from and your level of education. There are people who think it's a huge difference, and, you know, they're very adamant about being one or the other and demonizing the other mm-hmm. side. So again, I think it's just a question of education and understanding the faith. And of course, each country has different traditions, how they celebrate things. But Iran is the biggest Shiite country, majority Shiite country.
The majority.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about Sufism.
Okay.
I know you're an expert in this field. What is Sufism? Can you just very simply introduce this to us?
Sufism is nothing more than the mystical dimension within Islam. I mean, it's. I asked my teacher once, what's the difference? And he said there really isn't a difference. It's just one of degrees of worship. I mean, to be a Sufi, you still are a practicing Muslim. You're still saying your prayers, saying your, you know, giving alms, fasting if you can, going to the pilgrimage if you can. You're doing everything, but it's for me, it's understanding things from a higher perspective.
From a higher perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's striving to have a direct communion with God. It's basically what the mystical path is in any religion. Judaism has the Kabbalah. Christianity has the hesychastic tradition in the Orthodox Church. The mystics in the Catholic Church, many of them, I mean, we call them mystics. Why? Because they had this mystical experience of the divine. They had a real communion with God or with Jesus or with the Virgin Mary. And they were able to guide other people, parishioners, disciples, however you like to call them. And Islam has the same tradition, the mystical path. And you have a Sufi master, just like a guru in Hinduism. And or Buddhism, and you have, well, the Dalai Lama, I guess, would really be the spiritual leader of the Buddhists, but for Islam, there are many Sufi masters. There's different Sufi orders, and the orders, most of the orders started, they take their spiritual lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad through Ali, most of them through his son-in-law, Ali. And they call him Imam Ali. And others go back, very few go back to one of the other companions, Abu Bakr. But they trace their spiritual lineage back. So what that means is that you get, the prophet was initiated, so to speak, by the Archangel Gabriel. He received the divine message and revelation from God. Then the prophet initiated his companions, as it were. You could say, we don't call them disciples. Jesus had his disciples, the prophet had his companions. They were initiated into the teachings of Islam and mystical tradition and what so forth. And then they in turn had, many of them had followers and so forth. So the sheikh, or the Sufi master, is someone who has received the spiritual initiation from a previous master, and they can trace their spiritual lineage all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad via usually Imam Ali, his son-in-law, who was also his first cousin. And so in that tradition, you know, different branches developed, and so there are many branches today. I would say a lot of them began in the Middle Ages and continue, some of them continue till now. In the Middle Ages they peaked, but there were, taking their tradition all the way back to the prophet, they started, one great mystic said, in the beginning, Sufism was a name, was a reality without a name.
Was a reality
without a name. They just practiced what, you know, the Islamic teachings were all, what they practiced were really mystical traditions as well, combined, you know, it was all together. He said later on, it became a name without a reality. And I thought that was interesting because mm-hmm. there are people who call themselves Sufis, but they're not really Muslims, you know. So I guess, however you want to look at that, I strive to do the right thing. I don't really call myself a Sufi. I call myself someone aspiring to be. But it's a mystical tradition, and it helps to... The practices are meditation, remembering God in various ways, either through chanting the Quran, through prayer, through recitation of sacred names, through, in other cases, when in a ceremony called dhikr, and they actually, there's a ceremony where the Sufi master is leading everyone in a ritual of prayer. And that can vary from order to order. Some have a silent meditation they practice. Others, like the one I'm in, the Turkish order, Cerrahi, they actually have, they worship God with their whole body. It's wonderful. I mean, with song, with music, chanting, Quranic chanting, ilahis, as they call the spiritual songs that some of their masters have composed for when they were moved to compose, you know, inspired to compose beautiful music. And so, and the music is sung in certain modes, they call maqam, but the modes are a little different from Western music. And so there are instruments, drums and whatnot, and the flute called a nay, and just beautiful music. So we're praying and remembering God in various ways, you know, sitting, standing. The Quran says sitting, standing, or lying on your side. You should always remember God, and that all of creation remembers God. That's why you hear the birds chirping at dawn and sunset. If you've ever noticed, creation starts changes at those two times. This is an example of that they're remembering God, but we aren't aware of that.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of nature that, you know, wells up or subsides, depending if it's dawn or daybreak or a sunset. And I even noticed when I was out, you know, on the ocean, the waves even, everything seems to calm down. And if you're on the coast, things calm down at sunset. I mean, everything. And I noticed when I started to read the verses and it says that everything worships God. And I was noticing how the different creatures worship God, as the Quran says. And it's really amazing. And they seem to do it at the same time of the day. You know, many times at dawn or you hear crickets chirping or frogs or whatever. And then at night again. So it's a beautiful thought.
Yeah.
So, but Sufism is a spiritual path that through spiritual exercises you're given, and the initiation and then spiritual exercises, it helps you to get centered, to discipline yourself. And we all have different aspects of our personalities. Some people are very generous naturally. Others have to work at it. Some people are very patient. Others have to work at it. So whatever your weakness is, so to speak, that's what you're working on to become as they call it, an insan al-kamil, a complete or perfect human being. Mm-hmm. Not perfect in the sense, it's not really perfect, it's more like complete, because only God is perfect in Islam. So the idea of being complete is that you are balanced. You're not, you know, despairing when something sad happens, and you're not giddy if something great happens. I mean, you're balanced, and you see that all comes from God. So you are kind of balanced in that sense that you appreciate all the blessings of God, and you patiently endure all the tests. And we all have our tests. Some of them are really easy ones. Some of them become tragic, but everyone is tested. And if you can look at difficulties as, okay, what am I supposed to learn here? I think that helps you to not take it personally. Say, okay, we're all tested, so what's the lesson here for me?
It's more like the idea of inner peace.
Yes, exactly, to create a sense of inner peace and the awareness of the oneness of God, that we are all one. We were all created in His image, and even if people don't act like they were created in His image sometime, that you acknowledge that in them and let them be. You know, the Quran says if they're talking all sorts of things that they don't know anything about, just let them be. Just say Allah, you know, say God.
Be more tolerant.
Yeah, remember God and let them be. And as long as they're not harming anyone, of course, you know. There are definite rules about, like in any society, about murder or theft or whatever. But just let them be and go on your way and pray that they will be enlightened. That's the best thing you can do is pray for someone.
And this reminds me of a little bit of this idea of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Is forgiveness a very important concept in Islam?
Very, yes. Oh, yes. There are wonderful Sufi stories about people who were the victims of murder. You know, their family, someone in their family was murdered, and they forgave the person. And in Islam, you have two choices. You can either demand a blood wit, as they call it, payment for the shedding of blood. Mm-hmm. So, or you can actually exact punishment. And if you can forgive, it's better, because as it says, God forgives you. So as God forgives you, we should learn to forgive others. Sometimes we feel that the crime is so egregious we can't. I've known many people, Muslim and non-Muslim, who forgave someone who killed a member of their family, and I was so moved by their generosity. A few years ago, the Amish community, I think out in Pennsylvania, had a terrible tragedy when some man, young man, went in and killed a bunch of students in a school. And that community forgave him, and they even, and all sorts of money and aid was coming to them. And they gave some of that money to the widow of the killer.
Wow.
And because they wanted them not to feel that this was something that they should, you know, like not feel badly for what the husband did. There was no reflection on the wife and the children. So they didn't want them to be stigmatized or anything. And I just thought that was so noble.
So generous.
So generous, so compassionate. I mean, if you were in that situation, that's what I mean, practicing the golden rule. Do for others what you would want
for
yourself.
They were helping those widow and her children.
Oh, tremendous. And yet they were grieving too. So, yes, I mean, it's a noble, I mean, we're capable of some of the noblest sentiments ever, and we are also capable of some of the worst sentiments and behaviors. So it's just deciding which aspect of yourself do you want to focus on. Do you, as a Native American story I once heard, when this young boy asked his grandfather, the grandfather said, there are two wolves within me. Mm-hmm. One is anger and envy and so forth, and the other is compassion and generosity and love. And he said, well, which one wins, grandfather? Which wolf wins? He said, the one I feed.
The one I feed.
So what you focus on, that's what you're feeding. If you're focusing on the positive, on cultivating love and generosity and forgiveness and compassion, then you will become that way. The Sufi master is someone who helps get you there. It's hard sometimes when you're by yourself. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think it's important to find someone who can really mentor you. But it's, I think it's quite a privilege to find a real teacher.
Yeah.
Because there are people who claim to be, and they're not always.
And I think I really like the story. No matter, regardless whether you're religious or not, this story is so inspiring. You can always be the person you choose to be as long as you work on it.
Right, right. And learn from, you can learn from everyone. You can learn how not to behave if you see someone behaving badly. Or you can learn how to behave if you see someone behaving very well. I mean, take a cue from that person.
It's all your choice.
Right. I mean, the world is a teacher.
Yeah, okay. I think we're kind of running out of time. So is there any book you can recommend to our audience if they want to learn more about Islam or Sufism?
Oh, there's so many books out there. It's hard to choose one or two. I mean, actually, for a total beginner, I suppose Islam for Dummies is good. I hate that title, but it's it's really quite well done, because it was written by the former chairman of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Butler University in Indianapolis. So it's written by someone who's quite well-versed in religion. There are many Sayyid Hussein Nasr's books, N-A-S-R. He has some beautiful books on Sufism and Islam. There are others that are more sophisticated. I mean, they presuppose a certain level of understanding. Victor Danner's books. He was a professor at IU. And you could really just start with those basic books and look at their bibliography. But there's some standard ones out there. I can't think of everyone out there, but I know that the simpler ones.
The Islam for Dummies.
Yeah, I think, as a beginning. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, then go to the library. IU has a fabulous collection of books on Islam and different aspects of Islam, you know, whether you want the sociological or the religious or the Sufi or the Shiite or Sunni. I mean, there's just so many aspects of Islam that you can learn about. But the basic teachings, most books on Islam will give you the basic beliefs and practices and And even online, you can Google online. There are a lot of Islamic websites. You can just do that. Very easy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Today we've been talking to Dr. Marianne Fadeh about Islam.
Thank you for listening to Interchange. Your ideas, comments, and thoughts are welcome. Get in touch with us at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks to Shane Young for engineering tonight's show. Interchange is produced by William Morse. The executive producer is January Jones. Music by Jamil Effiam and the Jeff McLaughlin Quartet. Stay tuned now for the best of jazz on Stardust with Brother Tillman, right here on the best of community radio, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.